Are there criteria?
Yeah, you have to be a superstar game developer that has already made billions of dollars, right?
Yeah, and that's one of the people he introed in the Apple Arcade video was the guy who made Final Fantasy.
Just a small little game. I don't know if anybody's ever heard of that, you know, no. A little indie game out there.
So the criteria is step one, make Final Fantasy. Step two, apply to Apple Arcade. It's like, yeah. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 18 of the Swift Over Coffee podcast. I'm Paul Hudson.
And I'm Sean Allen.
And right now, Sean, I am in the last lap, the final straight of my 100 days of Swift. I think today is day 87 or so. You know, the end's in sight now. Like, there's light at the end of the tunnel. I can't tell if it's a train or the end of a bright, happy life at the end, but it's almost there. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, I'm curious. Like, I know I fell off. I fell off the 100 days of Swift train at about day 12 because I just got so much going on. But it seems like a lot of people are sticking with it because I know I get tagged in the tweets as well. I'm sure you do as well. So definitely feels like it was a hit, though. A lot of work, I bet, though.
It's been exhausting to do, but I know a lot of folks have benefited, so I'm glad, and I'm looking forward to being finished. I'll take a few days off, I think, for a change after that. It'd be so nice. Anyway, what are you up to?
Well, let's talk about something real quick that might be in the works. Some whispers here. Are we going to be at AltConf? Are we going to do something there? What's going on?
I certainly think so. So, you know, Sean and I have been talking to the organizers at AltConf to try and put together another Swift Over Coffee live podcast recording at AltConf. And if we can pull it off, we'll get space at AltConf. We'll get some wonderful guest hosts in, because obviously it's WWDC week, so lots of folks fly in for that. So we have to get some of our good friends in to join us on the stage and have a good time. Do probably a longer podcast, I think, Sean, because, you know, it's WWDC week.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe even raise some money for a charity. It'd be great.
Yeah, a lot of great things going on. I'm looking forward to it. Hopefully, again, nothing's official yet, but hoping we can pull that off. What else you got going on? You just released another app, or you're about to?
Yeah, so my Unwrap app for learning Swift is now in test flight beta 6. So it's getting close to release now. I'm really keen to get it out. It's been worked on for a long time with lots of breaks here and there. I want to get out the door now, ideally way before dub. And people have been so good. I've had some wonderful pull requests for that. So I'm almost there.
How many more betas are you going to keep with the Apple? Well, Apple usually does about 6 betas, right?
I think we'll do one more probably in the next couple of days, and that'll be it.
Nice. All right, let's move on to some news. And we're going to kick things off with a quick little update from what we talked about last episode. And that is about SE0255, implicit returns from single expression functions. And in case you missed last episode, a quick recap. Basically, if your function only has one line within the scope and it's the, you know, return whatever it's returning, you're going to be able to omit that return just like you can in closures.
Yeah, so I don't yet know is sort of the long-term impact on this for folks learning Swift. Because I remember when I was teaching Swift 2, you know, we all knew Swift 3 was coming. We all knew it was happening. There was a big reunification was happening. And I remember telling folks, listen, if you're doing Objective-C today, move to Swift now before the big rename. Yes, it means doing more work in the long term, but right now, Swift at least conceptually looks quite like Objective-C. You know, all those method names, you know, string replacing substring, whatever, exactly the same. Sure, there's tuples and, you know, protocols, whatever. There's other things that are in there that are nice, that operate overloading. But the actual methods you're calling are very, very similar. And that isn't the case after Swift 3. And what I now no longer know is these kinds of changes, like removing the return keyword for these kind of expressions, what does that mean for someone learning Swift today? Is it now pushing Swift even further away from the language you might recognize? Like, I haven't seen that before in Python or Objective-C or whatever. It makes it that little bit harder to learn. So even though I think it's good for us, we can go, oh, great, remove the return keyword, move on. It's easy for us. For beginners coming to this scratch, it makes it a little bit more alien, I think. We'll have to see.
And real quick, I think I forgot to mention at the beginning that the news update was that this has been officially accepted. So that's why we're updating there. Yeah. A little key piece of information you might want to know about the whole story.
It is happening for sure, that you can say goodbye to a lot of your returns. In fact, I'm worried actually because I've got a lot of these tests for Swift, language tests. And I'm sure there's a few of those saying, oops, you missed a return keyword. And now it's valid Swift.
All right, next up, we have another Swift evolution proposal, SE0259, approximate equality for floating points. And basically what this does is, you know, floating points, multiple decimals, they're not always, you know, perfectly equal. There's a little bit of inaccuracies there. So if you're trying to, you know, check to see if there's equality there, they might not be equal in that sense. So this proposes is almost equal to, and then you can also set like a threshold as well. So kind of alleviates those errors a little bit.
I love this change for two reasons. First, it's good. It's this wonderful thing of, is this number almost equal to some other number? It sounds almost like an April Fool's joke.
It does. It sounds like a joke.
Yeah, but it's called literally, if X is almost equal to Y. That's the exact thing they're pitching, which is great. But it just sounds like a joke, but it really is true. And the other reason I love it is because more people need to realize this stuff's really hard. You know, if you did this yourself, the sort of traditional way of doing this, you'd say, listen, oh yeah, is X minus Y less than some error? Some error, 0.0001. That's the error I've decided is my error range. That's my margin that's allowable. Is it less than that? And that's terrible. That's really, really bad code. And I've done that same thing. Because for very, very small numbers, you know, your number might be less than that you're comparing, suddenly your error margin's huge. Or if your numbers are, you know, 18 trillion, whatever, an error of 0.001, if it is irrelevant, you want an error much larger because the scale of these things moves around. That's the magic of floating point. So too many people, including myself sometimes, don't really grasp how hard these things are. And it's one of those cases where the standard library really excels itself because, you know, places where we know this thing is easy to get wrong, it's easy to screw up, easy to make performance problems, that's where the standard library is to come in and say, here is the right solution, just use ours.
Next up, we have a quick little story about Swift 5.1 snapshots are now available. So if you're that weirdo type of person that likes to get out way ahead of even the betas and you're downloading the snapshots, there you go, they're available. I don't know anybody like that. Do you, Paul?
I've already been using 5.1.
Yeah, exactly.
So 5.1 is here for realsies this time. I love it. I mean, it's another set of good changes, including, you know, 255 implicit returns. I'm hoping to see 250, the formatting system. We've got opaque result types almost certainly landing in there, the new generic math stuff. There's all sorts of things landing in there. And I'm expecting WWDC first beta. I mean, we'll see, right?
You would think, right? Yeah, it seems everything's lining up to that, it seems.
Well, it's going to include module stability, which is a sort of second half of ABI stability. So It seems a good target to aim for. I know the team are working really, really hard on it. I'm looking forward to seeing that. And it's going to be a really nice follow-on from 5.0. You know, 5.0 has been so hard for them to get real ABI stability in there. That's done now. In theory, the floodgates can open.
Yeah. Moving on, we have a little bit of industry news. Realm was acquired by MongoDB. And I know a lot of people may use Realm, and I wanted to bring this up because it brought back some nightmares. I had a project when... my backend was built on Parse, and then Facebook acquired Parse, and it was like, oh, cool, finally this small startup is going to have some big backing. A few months later, they announced, you know, Facebook is shutting down Parse, and your whole backend gets shut down. Now, there's like Parse on the server. There was workarounds to it, but according to the blog post on this acquisition, this is not going to happen yet. They say, you know, at this time, that's in the blog post. So
not this time.
The point is, if you are relying heavily on Realm, I'm not saying anything's going to happen, but I would pay attention to this and kind of keep your eyes open.
Yeah, the words at this time were the most important three words in that entire press release, because it basically means it's going to happen in about 6 months. I think it's interesting because, firstly, many people, including myself, I think, realized MongoDB is actually a company. Right. It's a real thing with a lot of money behind it to be able to buy companies like Realm. But secondly, the really sad thing was they were bought for $39 million when they received $40 million on investment. And as a startup, you know for a fact, so many of the engineers were promised shares or stocks, whatever, something in the company in lieu of higher salary. And with that kind of buyout, a negative investment buyout, they're going to get nothing. And that's really sad. And that number, 39 million, I reckon that's intentionally less, one less than 40 million.
Right.
Quite clear, you're getting nothing out of this whatsoever. It's really quite sad.
Moving on, and more kind of keep your eye out news, Docker Hub had a security breach. So your Docker passwords and your GitHub tokens may have been exposed. So again, just like if you were relying on Realm, watch out. If you were relying on Docker, make sure you check that.
I saw a great take on this from Rebecca Slatkin, who is an extremely funny woman on Twitter from the iOS community, who said, finally, being too proud to ask a coworker what a popular computer program does pays off, says developers everywhere. And that's so true because a lot of folks are aware of Docker, but don't really know what it does. And I have used Docker quite a lot. I have actually things on Docker Hub because in the server-side Swift world, it's really important to be able to make things easily through Docker to deploy things very quickly. It's actually even an official Swift Docker repository from the Apple team. So it is important, but fortunately it hit only, 5% of people?
Yeah, it wasn't many.
Yeah, but it's still your GitHub token. So if you have that, if you had your GitHub token on Docker Hub, get it out of there sharpish, otherwise you are in trouble.
All right, as always, we got our picks for the episode. What do you got for us, Paul?
So my pick this week is a framework called Zephyr by Arthur Zabintsev, and it's a library for synchronizing user defaults with iCloud. So I mentioned earlier, I wrote this Unwrap app as a way to help folks learn Swift on the move, but I wrote it specifically for iPhone because I personally, carry around my iPhone everywhere with me. I don't really, carry my iPad around much day. And after 3 test flight betas, after a lot of work, when things are sort of getting nice and stable, someone opened up a PR on GitHub adding iPad support. But it turns out they just changed the device category from iPhone to universal.
So you thought somebody was going to like really, really contribute to the project and really take a load off your shoulders, and they just clicked the button. And let me guess, that didn't look very good, right? Just that stretched iPhone experience.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of that. We discussed that a little bit on GitHub, and they made an important point, which is that users who want an iPad version would just run the iPhone version anyway. Now, I never do that, right? I get iPad apps or iPhone apps. I never run iPhone apps on iPad. But he said he does, so people will do it also.
Yeah, I guess people do it. Yeah, I mean, I know as soon as I see that stretched iPhone, I'm like, nope, next app. Like,
exactly, yeah. So it's either, his point was you either accept iOS's scaled up iPhone port or you get the native iPad experience, which is still a scaled up iPhone version, but at least it looks, fits the screen, right? It looks kind of better. But of course, making things actually work well on iPad was not straightforward. Lots of views were now way too big, some layouts just didn't work, etc. So it took me another week or so of changes to make things actually work well enough on iPad that I'd be happy to actually ship this thing without being, ashamed of myself. And then the real problem hits. If someone uses both devices to follow the learning plan to learn Swift in the app, how do we synchronize their progress between devices?
I just heard about this really, really cool thing called Zephyr. Is it? I think it might help you out.
Yeah. So that's exactly where Zephyr came in, helpfully, all the code for Unwrap's on GitHub, and a contributor called Wayne Neihart sent in a PR that added iCloud support. Now, he actually copied Zephyr into the Unwrap project, so he could modify the code to update our UI when iCloud sync happened. We've got new data, reload the UI. But fortunately, Zephyr's also open source, so I sent in a PR that made it post a sort of a user notification when it happened. So we could then grab that and reload our UI. And once that was done, Wayne switched across to a CocoaPod, and Zephyr worked just brilliantly. And I know there are a few other options out there for syncing user defaults with iCloud, but I really like Zephyr's easy API. It can sync all keys or only selected keys. It can monitor for change automatically. It's got a really nice debugging mode. And plus, they have wonderful Swift backcompat support too. So it ports all the way back to Swift 3, I think, or 3.1 or so. All with different tags in the repository, all placed nicely. So it's really, really great to see. Anyway, that's my discovery. What's yours, Sean?
My discovery, even though it's been around for a while, it's a discovery to me because I just started using it, and that's got to be SwiftLint. I had so much fun installing SwiftLint in my project this past 2 weeks. If you're not familiar with what SwiftLint is, it's a linter by Realm. We just talked about them. That was mostly written by JP Simard, who's now at Lyft. But if you're not familiar with what a linter is in general, it's a tool to enforce, style and conventions. And, with SwiftLint, I can have warnings appear right next code when I'm breaking one of these style or convention rules. And these are completely customizable, by the way. Things such as having too many lines in a single function.
So you must have known about SwiftLint, like conceptually.
Yeah, I had actually seen JP give a talk at Realm, a couple years ago. I was at the talk, and it's funny.
And he thought, nah.
It's funny. I just had to rewatch that talk, and it's kind of funny rewatching a talk that you were there in person. But it was so many years ago. I was like, I need a refresher.
So this year alone, you're trying out testing, you're trying out SwiftLint, you delivered your first conference talk. This is like Sean Allen coming of age year.
I know, I'm putting on my big boy pants, I guess. just getting started here. But yeah, no, like I said, I had a ton of fun installing that into Aluna this week because, you know, I was always the solo developer or at most working with one other developer. So having a linter, you know, I can enforce my own kind of style conventions. I mean, don't get me wrong, I do see the value for a solo developer, but, you know, I just kind of never got around to doing it. But now that we've hired a second developer and I'll be moving on from Aluna, my main responsibility is going to be reviewing pull requests. So now that my time is on the line, it's like, okay, now we need a linter, right? So because most of my comments on his pull requests were stylistic. So having a linter take care of this, you know, at compile time definitely saves a lot of time. And, you know, because I've seen, like I mentioned, JP speak and talk about SwiftLint, there are other linters out there, but this is the reason why I chose SwiftLint.
You know, I've been coding for a long time. And I have, I think it's fair to say, pretty clear mental rules about how I write code. And trust me, that's a euphemism for being stubborn at the way I program. But I still like adding SwiftLint to my projects because I know it means for sure that all the code is in the right shape. You know, it's one less thing I have to worry about when I'm doing code review.
Yeah, and let's kind of go over SwiftLint and kind of these rules at a high level real quick, you know, because there's over 75 of these rules, but not all of them are on by default. You have a, you know, a group of them that are disabled by default and then a group of them that are on. And the ones that are on by default are things that are, you know, accepted as convention. Things like when using an if statement, you don't wrap your conditional in parentheses and you can turn or tweak these values as necessary. There's another group of rules that are disabled by default, but you can turn them on. And again, you can customize them. And I was just having a blast turning these rules on and running my project to see, you know, where it broke. Things like preferring the use of .toggle and .random, or a crazy one that I implemented and actually fixed every file. And that was putting your import statements in alphabetical order. But I think this one might be going a bit too far.
Are you kidding? I did a Swift on Sundays today about ARKit and Apple's AR template. Puts its import in reverse alphabetical order. It took so much mental willpower not to reorder them.
So does that mean your import statements are normally ordered alphabetically?
Oh, yeah. The first thing I do.
That's the thing. I had actually never heard of that. And I saw that rule and I was like, oh, let me try this. And like every single one of my files was broken. I had to go fix it. But is that a common convention? I'd never heard of that.
It is very common. In fact, I did it in a video recently and I said, okay, I'm going to add, I think it was like multi-peer connectivity above UIKit. And I just pause to say, just in case you weren't sure, folks, you don't have to put it above. Well, it's like change the compile thing. I have to put it there by law. You can put it below if you really want to, but you know, come on. Because the thing is, we deal with computers all day, right? The most pedantic things in existence. It naturally, I think, rubs off on us, making us equally pedantic.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I've never heard of that one. But anyway, interesting to see that you have implemented that for a while. But
have you seen the is empty rule? That's very interesting.
I did. I liked it. I could have talked about rules for 3 hours, Paul. That's why I had to like pick one or two to keep the show rolling. But I had so, like I said, I had so much fun with all these rules. But go ahead, tell them what it is.
Well, it's because using is empty is much faster than saying count is equal to zero because of the way strings work particularly. But it's interesting because it's opt-in because there are the bridged versions like NSArray and NSSet don't have is empty. Mm. They only have count. And so it can't be on by default, which is a real shame. It's a great rule for performance. So I would recommend folks enable it. You know, if you find using, you know, NS map table, for example, which is not quite as empty, fine, you can do opt outs. But broadly speaking, it affects most of us. It's a good thing. So opt that one in.
Yeah. And my last piece of advice for anybody interested in, you know, putting in SwiftLint into the project, the sooner the better. So the Aluna code base that I put it in is, it's about a year old. So I installed SwiftLint and my little yellow warnings at the top of Xcode just read 999. Plus, like the counter gave up, you know, and based on how many warnings I ended up clearing before getting below 999 plus, I would guess I had about 1400 warnings. And don't get me wrong, a large chunk of those was the trailing white space rule, which you may find your project has a lot of, but Xcode actually has a setting where you can automatically trim that, but that setting's not on by default. You have to do that yourself. Anyway, that's a whole nother story. But the sooner you can get this into your project, the better, so you don't have to clear 1400 warnings. But I love having SwiftLint in my projects, and I think any like serious project I do moving forward will probably have it.
While I wholeheartedly second that people should be using a linter, if they've managed to go this long, I might suggest they wait a couple more months because I kind of suspect Apple will launch its own linter around WWDC thanks to SE0250, the style guide, which Apple seemed very keen on, or the Swift team seemed very keen on. But there's no reason, you know, you can't get ahead of the game, right? You know, any rule Swift enforces will likely also be enforceable with the Swift format or whatever Apple produce. And now it's time for our open ballot. And our question this time was, do you think Apple Arcade will be good for the wider iOS game development community? Once again, we had lots of answers here, but I think they were almost entirely positive.
Yeah, I actually expected the opposite.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I expected developers to be more cynical, but yeah, I was expecting, you know, outcry, but we didn't get that.
This means you are not the most optimistic man in the world, Sean. I'm surprised.
I'm optimistic, but I expected other people to not be optimistic.
So we had some answers here about how it's going to raise the general benchmark of iOS gaming. Michaela Caron said, it kind of sucks that some companies are making super simple games with horrible UX, too many ads, and yet making lots of money just because so many people are downloading the app. And George Elsham said, I think that Apple Arcade will benefit the wider iOS community. It'll push lazy developed games full of ads, listed in the top three charts further out, encouraging more effort and bigger games to be made. You know, it's as possible. I look forward to there being less trashware, less scamware in the App Store. Of course I do. You know, we mentioned before, I think, Lemmings, a classic Amiga game, was come back to the App Store with, of course, stacks of IAPs for, I think, 60, 70 bucks now.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure it's going to do much for the charts. I mean, I don't think Apple Arcade will mix in with the charts, because otherwise it'll completely dominate the charts every month. As any game launches, boom, it'll be in top charts because everyone subscribes to Apple Arcade. Well, not everyone, but quite a few folks will. So I'm not sure it'll have much effect on the charts. And I think we'll always have scamware, quite frankly. We'll always have these kind of lazy games.
Yeah, I think so. But I do agree that it is I think it's a good step in the right direction to hopefully weed that out or demotivate that or disincentivize that is what I'm trying to say. But I do agree with you that I think it might be a futile effort.
Michael Lyson said, I think it'd be good for more interesting games / experiences, more likely to be made knowing there's a guaranteed market. And Peter Jakub said, Apple Arcade will be contributing to the growth of storytelling games, 100% sure.
I actually kind of agree with this sentiment that we should be seeing more variety of games. You know, people aren't, you know, pursuing that bottom line, right? Having to make the profitable game because they're already, you know, making money off the subscription. So I do agree that I do think we're going to see some, you know, experimental games. However, I'm not sure this really answers the question of how does it affect the iOS game community, you know, from a developer's perspective.
There's already a great many games that are interesting and experimental. You know, Steam had that wonderful Greenlight project for a long time. There's been Xbox indie games. There are stacks. I mean, I go on the Switch almost every day and look at the games on there. And there's lots and lots of independent games. But I'm not sure they're making, you know, serious money. You know, a few are breakthroughs. Of course they are. You know, Monument Valley was, of course, a groundbreaking, extraordinary game. And there are some like that. But I don't necessarily think we're going to see more or less of that thanks to Apple. What I do think we'll see is that, you know, Apple are saying there's a $500 million budget, I believe, across 100 games. So that's $5 million per game, approximately. And that will be interesting because it means there's no risk of failure. They can go in and try and make a game and see what comes out. And I think it'd be naive to assume they're all going to work. You know, if they said, hey, Sean, here's $5 million, please make an experimental game.
Right.
There's a high chance that's a high risk problem. You're gonna script a few of those things. So, you know, we'll see. I worry that it's not necessarily going to do everything we'd hoped.
Yeah, I think we're going to see almost like a Netflix effect, right? How, you know, the Netflix original shows, there's probably a handful of them that are like really amazing. And then the other 7,332 are meh, you know, so kind of like you said, I think they're just looking for probably a handful of runaway hits to maybe, you know, carry the Apple Arcade brand and then maybe the next generation of games, you know, to come through.
Yeah, but what happens then if they launch a game that isn't great? I mean, do Apple nix it?
I don't know.
You know, there's a whole thing about Shigeru Miyamoto from Nintendo would upend the tea table. He'd like say, we're not going to ship this game. We've got
right.
Massive changes here. Apple are clearly footing the bill for these games. If it gets 95% and kind of like, this is a bit ropey.
Yeah, but also like what, I remember when the rumors of Apple Arcade first came out, like what's the metric? You know, is it time spent in app? So now are you incentivizing game makers to, you know, make these addicting games that people are always in? Or is it, you know, can a fast, quick, fun, amazing game, you know, I don't know, what's the metric?
You know, I think actually from Apple's perspective, the metric might not matter because I believe that they're asking all games that ship on Apple Arcade to be cross-platform across macOS and tvOS and iOS with a single iCloud save game. So you can basically switch between these games on all platforms freely. And that means if Apple Arcade even vaguely works, you know, more than Ping, for example, it'll mean that the iOS Halo love will spread to macOS and tvOS, where they're crying out for more games. You know, tvOS is, you know, the future of TV is apps, right? That's what we were told. And it hasn't really worked out that way yet. And if we can get a bit of iOS spreading out to those platforms, it'd be really nice. Some folks here are saying this is a starting point and it'll grow in the future. Gregory Leck says, any commitment to iOS as a solid gaming platform is a step in the right direction. Major studios will mostly benefit, but I hope there'll be a trickle-down effect for indies. It'd be cool if Apple would proactively support games made with SpriteKit and SceneKit. And Thert Nemacek said, maybe devs would want to be included in the arcade, so they start making games that would meet the criteria. I don't think Apple ever proactively support games made with SpriteKit, because so many games aren't. They may be Unity or similar. And I just don't see a trickle-down effect. God, I feel awfully negative here, folks. You know, I can't see a trickle-down effect. Not with the, you know, Final Fantasy dude and Sonic's in there as well. Sonic the Hedgehog's in there. There are some people in there, big, like Beyond the Steel Sky people are in there as well. These are some big companies with a history of...
Sega?
Yeah. Big companies. So trickle-down, it's going to trickle a heck of a long way down before we even see a slight uplift anywhere else. And I don't think there are criteria. I don't think it's what you know. I think it's more who you know.
Yeah, and I'm going to kind of echo the negativity just because, like I said, I expected there to be an outcry of like, no, this is going to really hurt the indie game developer scene. That's what I expected all the responses to be, but we didn't get that. And for that reason, I think this is going to kind of set aside like the upper echelon of games, the people that are lucky enough to get involved in Apple Arcade. And then there's going to be a huge gap because people are, what is it, $9.99 a month? I think if people are paying $9.99 a month, they're going to, you know, really think before they fork out any more money, you know, for an indie game that's not a part of Apple Arcade.
Yeah, absolutely. And particularly if Apple start rolling it into sort of, you know, Apple Plus plan. Get TV Plus, you know, get Apple Arcade, get music, whatever. Just give us $40 a month and we'll give you your Apple life. It's iLife all over again. Even better, give us $100 a month and we'll upgrade your phone. $200 a month, upgrade your iPad and your Apple Watch. I mean, I would sign up for that. You know, I don't even use Apple Music in the other one.
Stop, but... Paul. You're spending my money right now. Every new idea, I'm like, oh man, that's going to cost me money.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's going to be difficult to justify going beyond that. Particularly because, you know, $10 a month. We think about it. People were complaining about, oh, wow, this game's $2.
Yeah, yeah.
Why is it not $1, you know?
So what is a one-time purchase, $2, you know, not a recurring monthly thing.
Correct. And for that $10, fine, you get 100 games, but it won't be 100 new ones every month, will it?
No.
And finally, we have one here from Chris Connor saying, assuming Apple puts some marketing behind it and promote all games in the service, then I think it could be great for indie developers especially to contribute their games. And by attracting AAA titles, Apple is increasing the stature of their platform in the gaming community.
Kind of like we just said, I don't think the indie developers will contribute their games until... You know, I'm going to put my optimist hat back on. Let's say this, you know, super exclusive club of developers right now is just the start, right? Let's fast forward the clock 5-10 years or however many. And then now they've opened up Apple Arcade. So it's accessible at least. I'm not saying they open it up to everybody, but if you've proven that you make good quality, solid games, you can get into Apple Arcade, then I'm all on board with this comment. But as of now, that's not the case. That's going to wrap it up for this episode of Swift Over Coffee. But as always, we want to leave you with something to think about, and that is next episode's open ballot. And here we go. What are your tips for doing effective code reviews?
I don't know, Sean. Have you discovered any useful automated tools for that recently?
None. None at all. Yeah, it's like, just kidding. We're just going to throw Swiftlint in and call it a day, right? I thought Swiftlint does the code review for you, right? That's what it does? All right, tell all your friends to subscribe and leave a review. Like I said, we'll be your best friends forever and ever. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter @SwiftOverCoffee. We'll talk to you in the next one.
Bye.